Welcome to the Alt Asset Allocation Podcast, exploring alternative investment opportunities available to the everyday investor. Here's your host, Ben Lakoff.
Hello and welcome to the Alt Asset Allocation Podcast. Today's interview is with Bored Elon Musk. What started as a parody account nearly 8 years ago, Bored is a massive presence on Twitter and a very large presence in the crypto space now with over 1.8 million followers on Twitter. Yeah, and we did this live on Twitter Spaces. It was mad. If you haven't joined one yet, please join it. You can follow me at Ben Lakoff on Twitter or at Invest in Alts. That's the Alt Asset Allocation Twitter, and they are really fun because we have a Q&A section that I cut out. But Bored Elon is in the process of transitioning to full entrepreneur and operator. From his roots in gaming, he's going all in on blockchain gaming. In this episode, we cover what is blockchain gaming, where it is right now, why it's important, and where it could be going from his bird's eye view in the space. We talk about his upcoming company, Bored Boxes, which I'm actually really excited about launching in May. Before you listen, please don't forget to like or subscribe to the podcast, or even better, leave a review. If you're watching it on YouTube, please give it a like or subscribe to the channel, share it with a friend. All of these things help spread the word and keep this thing going, and I really, really appreciate it. All right, here we go. Enjoy this episode with Bored Elon Musk.
Bored, welcome to the Alt Asset Allocation Podcast. Excited to have you on today.
Thank you, Ben. Looking forward to our chat.
I listened to your AMA this morning, and I'm super excited about Bored Boxes. We'll definitely get into that later. Really great stuff, and I'm super excited. But typically, I kind of start off with background. Typically, perhaps not that relevant since you're anon 8 years now. But, you know, for my audience that doesn't know yet who you are, let's talk about a little bit about your process from starting as a parody account and transitioning into what your identity online has grown to become to today.
Yeah, I sort of have two primary identities, I guess you could say, and I've shared a little bit about the real world version. So I'm happy to kind of provide a bit of context to both. But Bored Elon has existed for about 8 years now. I started the account in August of 2013, the same day that Elon Musk, the real Elon Musk, put out a white paper for the Hyperloop high-speed train design that essentially he said he didn't have time to build, but he wanted to kind of open source that idea so other people could create it. And that was sort of the framework that inspired this idea of, you know, what does Elon think about in his downtime when he's bored, when he's taking a walk, when he's sitting on the porcelain throne, if you will. And so as somebody who's always been interested in creative writing and comedy writing, it was a really great set of lines to color within. And luckily for me, he remained in the spotlight. So I think I inadvertently chose, you know, a real person to parody who was probably the perfect individual, because fast forward 8 years later, and he is, you know, arguably the most important person on Twitter and most well-known person on Twitter. So that was a bit of luck that I didn't anticipate. But for the first 5 to 6 years of the account, it was very much kind of a one-dimensional parody. I didn't respond to people, didn't do any voice stuff, didn't really reveal anyone, you know, reveal any information behind, you know, the real me. And that worked well. It got really, you know, picked up and shared around Silicon Valley. Lots of people in tech appreciated it. And a lot of the content was just kind of like silly inventions that were trying to solve everyday problems that people could connect to. And that's really kind of what gained me the following. It was just kind of that consistent type of content that resonated. And, you know, that tends to work pretty well for what you would call a meme account or a parody account. But as time went on, I decided to branch out a little bit and pull some of the real world self into the equation and turn Bored Elon into something beyond, you know, just kind of a one line generator. And so, you know, that's where I did started doing things like podcasts and responding to people and actually like partnering with different organizations and investing in startups. And so it's kind of like a cryptocurrency where you have to decide, do you want to trade security for like, you know, speed and opportunity? And so as I kind of reduced security a little bit with Bored Elon by revealing more of the real self, that increased my ability to transact with people and organizations. And so what you have today is kind of a hybrid of what Bored Elon, you know, started off with, which is still, you know, some funny thoughts and reactions and inventions, but also a little bit of, you know, a focus on things that I'm interested in the real world, which is blockchain and technology and in particular gaming. And that kind of brings us to today, where, you know, this parody account has gone from what started off as kind of a side hustle, fun creative exercise to a pretty serious, you know, media business / you know, investment vehicle / startup founder.
Yeah, that's amazing. I was just clicking through to your profile. 1.7 million followers. That is a media at this point. I also can't believe that the Hyperloop thing was 8 years ago. My God, time flies. That's incredible. How long before they converge? I would imagine with investing, KYC and personal data and like kind of revealing a bit about your background. Do you have a goal before, like, you know, the kind of word is out before these two identities converge a bit?
I certainly am not going to proactively try to reveal who I am. I always like the idea of, you know, rich, not famous, not rich and famous. I don't see a lot of upside to me personally or, you know, my family and friends. I think ultimately there is probably a limit to how long I can keep the mystery up. The primary reason, honestly, that I just like for the, you know, for the identity to remain sort of synonymous is that I just think it's fun. It's part of the brand. People can kind of project their own image or their own assumptions onto Bored and try to guess who it is. I often use the analogy of Banksy, you know, and not necessarily wanting to know who that is because it'll probably be a disappointment. It'll just be sort of an average person who's like, you know, not that extraordinary. And so there's something special to just kind of keep the mystery alive. So, you know, I've tried my best to keep it a secret. I'm not going to try to dox myself. I hope other people don't. And a big part of that, honestly, is just, you know, acting in a trustworthy, transparent way, you know, being ethical, being a nice person. And I think that I've got at least 2 years left in me keeping the secret alive.
That's awesome. Well, I mean, you know, building off of gaming, it's kind of normal to have these like pseudo anonymous characters, different identity for different ecosystems. But I'd be curious, and before we go into gaming, because I promise I will get into that, but like, what is the hardest part of living this dual identity, kind of having different identity in the meat space versus online?
It's, you know, I think that there are two hard things. One is that to conduct business as Bored, there's a little bit of trust and risk, right? So when I'm working with someone, you know, usually that involves like a non-disclosure agreement and the hope that, you know, that is adhered to and nobody messes up by accident. And that's always a risk. And the more investments I make and the more partnerships I do, you know, the greater the risk is. So that's definitely a challenge. And the other part is a little bit less, I guess, important and more of just kind of a weird nuance, which is there's this really big thing in my life that is significant. And I think objectively a cool story to tell, but there are very few people in the real world in my actual like meat space life that I can even begin to explain all of this to, right? Like people in our space think, man, this is normal, but going to a family party or, you know, going to an event where I'm meeting new people for the first time, like this is not something I can really talk about. And so it feels like I have to kind of hide a part of myself because I don't want to share it with people I don't know. And it also seems really weird to the average person. So, you know, tiny violin, obviously for me, that's not a really real problem, but it's just, yeah, it's a weird nuance to life that I experience.
It is a problem. And I always just kind of assumed it was ego. It's like, for me, what would make it difficult? I want to tell people about the cool things I'm working on and you're not able to, but I didn't even think about that at like dinner parties. Like, what do you do? And you're like, yeah, it's like some obscure, probably templated response for these people.
I just had this happen to me last night. It was a dinner with you know, some friends that I had recently met. And, you know, years ago, I could say, oh, well, I'm an executive at this company and I work in this industry. But now that I'm sort of doing this full time, this conversation is very difficult. That, like, that question of what do you do is very hard to answer right now.
Oh yeah. Well, you know, could be worse, I suppose. Tiny violin.
Yes.
There we go. You've been in crypto, I've heard from other podcasts, since 2013, which is very, very early. So let's talk a bit about what initially attracted you to the space. And I know you kind of left for a little bit, but then what aspect of crypto kind of rejuvenated you and got you back into what you're focused on today?
Yeah, I mean, the 2013 days were very much just me being a curious individual and trying to solve for a problem, which was I was frustrated with the current sort of financial infrastructure and being able to send money to different people around the world and not have all these fees. And so, you know, the idea of like electronic money was super cool. And I remember getting like some of my first Bitcoin on Mt. Gox, and pretty clunky experience, but you know, it was fun to just play around with it and figure out how it worked. And like many people, you know, even though I was buying Bitcoin at like $8, I of course didn't hold it through today. I sold it around 100, thinking how smart I was at that time. And, you know, I guess you could argue a 10X is not a bad thing, but I would probably be just, you know, hanging out with Michael Saylor right now if I had held on to all that stuff back then. But yeah, that got me curious and sort of, you know, took me down the path of learning about different coins that were also trying to solve for the problem of kind of, you know, cross-border payments and low fees. But yeah, then took a bit of a hiatus, I think, like many people, because there was a bit of a kind of a stagnant period in the world of crypto where development was continuing, but just adoption wasn't super high. And then really got, you know, kind of reinterested in it in a deep way late 2019, early 2020. And I think as the pandemic rolled on and, you know, much like many other people around the world, I was pretty bored at home and had nothing to do. and then I think as NFTs really kind of became more mainstream, I guess, relative to overall internet culture, that was what really sucked me in, because to me, it felt like a product or a genre of products that I could really kind of align myself with, because, you know, Bored Elon is this digital identity that doesn't necessarily operate in the real world, much like NFTs are this digital asset or property or item that also doesn't necessarily connect to the real world. And so that took me down a rabbit hole. And I, you know, I went through the various paths that I think many others did, which was art and collectibles. And where I finally landed, where I'm focusing most of my attention, is gaming, just because, you know, as I've kind of shared publicly before, like that's the industry that I came from, and I see so much potential. And so since the 2020 and 2021 days, it's become an enormous part of, you know, my areas of interest. I talk about it a lot on my feed, to the annoyance of some people who miss my old content. and it's very much where I'm like focusing my investing and my building.
Yeah. Awesome. I mean, so like, well, firstly, the exponential age, people poo-pooing at 10x returns. I love this space so much. It's just hilarious. But yeah, so like, you know, 3 billion gamers overall, you're obviously super psyched about this niche. Let's zoom out a bit and kind of set the stage for why. You call it Web3 or blockchain gaming, or kind of synonymous at this point. But whatever, the Web3 or blockchain gaming is the most interesting thing at the moment. And why does this have so much potential?
Yeah, I personally, I've been referring to it as blockchain gaming. I feel like it's a very kind of broad description for it. I see the potential of gaming in general, right? I think in the last 10 years, especially, the industry of gaming has in many ways eclipsed other types of entertainment, including television, and one could argue all of Hollywood. The pandemic especially was quite a boon for video games. You know, as people were kind of stuck at home, there were certain titles that just had enormous popularity. I remember Animal Crossing was one of those that like it that ended up, you know, selling 3 or 4x, I think, what people were predicting, just because it was like the perfect game to play when everything outside was scary. And so when you look at sort of the trajectory of gaming overall, you see how much value is being generated by players through their investment of time and creativity and money as well. And a lot of that value is not necessarily, or hasn't necessarily, been going back to the players. It's been going to the game publishers. And, you know, of course, like people who are creating the games deserve to, you know, be making money off of them. It takes money to produce a game and to continue to update it and make sure that it's operating correctly. But there's also a lot of money that is in the sort of ecosystem of video games, which I'll just kind of broadly describe as like, you know, user acquisition and marketing, that has been used to, you know, grow player bases. And that money, I think, is really untapped and can be going back to players in a way that it hasn't before. And the way that can happen is through, you know, players actually owning parts of the games that they are playing, whether they're assets or actually like, you know, tokens in a game. There are a lot of opportunities for people to basically get some of the value back that they're putting into games. And that at a broad level is why I'm so bullish on this idea of blockchain gaming. I think it's in favor of gamers and of players. And the biggest problem is not, you know, technology or you know, the ability for game designers and publishers to get on board. I think it's just a matter of education and, you know, the patience we have to exercise to make sure that people who are less comfortable with crypto are able to, you know, onboard and get more familiar with the space so that they don't see it as, you know, a scam, and so they aren't skeptical of the space, but rather embrace it and see it for the value it can bring to them.
Yeah, and that's great, but that touches on kind of the potential negative connotation that some people have about blockchain gaming in general. What common narrative about blockchain gaming in general do you hear often that you disagree with or that you think is wrong?
There are several areas of FUD against blockchain gaming, and I discount most of them, but the one that I think has the most validity and the one that I really like to acknowledge the most is that players are sometimes concerned that games that over-index on sort of the economics and, you know, potential profits that a player can make is going to ruin the game, meaning that, you know, there are a lot of players who are there for the pure entertainment of the game. They want to have fun. They want to connect with friends. They want to, you know, complete challenges. And that if there are ways for people to come in and potentially exploit the system and then take certain actions that will generate lots of profits for them, those people who are doing that are going to ruin the game and the fun for everybody else. And so I think that's 100% valid. And I understand that criticism. And so my take is that, you know, the best game designers are going to really have to find a way to balance that and create games that can operate where both parties are happy. So essentially what I mean by that is, a really good blockchain game needs to be fun if you are not putting any money into it. So, you know, free to play, you never spend a dime. That's fine. It also needs to be fun for the people who do want to own assets and do want to, you know, put money into the system. And the key thing is that both parties have to remain happy and not be able to inflict a negative experience on the other. So one of the analogies I was thinking about today is professional sports. And so, you know, somebody might watch soccer on TV and, you know, enjoy that experience, cheer for their team, maybe go to a game. None of that requires any money. That's just an experience that they can enjoy for free. On the other hand, you have people who do bet on games or they do fantasy sports and there's money involved in that. And the key thing is that none of those people who are playing any of these sort of monetary games around the sport are going to damage the experience for those who are playing for free. And so that's kind of what needs to happen for blockchain gaming. And I think the problem right now is there's too much overlap of players who are there to play for free and for those who are there to basically do work and make money. And so it's on the game publishers, honestly, to fix that problem and prove to players that they can do both and serve all parties at the same time without destroying the experience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's timing is a big thing. Like, I think people always misconstrue what blockchain gaming looks like today and what it could look like in 5 years. So, like, that's a huge thing, right? Because I'd be curious from your perspective, blockchain gaming right now, is anybody doing it particularly well? If so, what are they doing and what are they kind of missing?
Yeah, I mean, I'll mention two games in particular, and I'll note that I'm a investor and or advisor in them, but one is Mini Royale Nations, which is a first-person shooter, you know, might feel close to like a Fortnite-style game. It's a browser-based game, which really makes it accessible. And that one lets you just kind of jump in and play. You don't have to spend any money. You don't have to buy any assets. It's a really great onboarding experience because it gets you hooked on the game first and then sort of, you know, brings on-chain activities later. And the other is Voxy Tactics, which is a tactical turn-based strategy game similar to like Advanced Wars or Mario versus Rabbids, if anyone is familiar with those titles. And again, it's a game that can be played for free, doesn't require you to spend any money or buy any assets, but it gives you the option to do so if you want to. And so I think they're both taking a similar approach in the sense of like, you know, bring people into a game, onboard them into the crypto experience later. I think in terms of, you know, things that could be done better, the reality is that right now, the vast majority of traditional gamers are not familiar with things like, you know, having a web wallet or how to buy crypto. And so these games, much like many others, they do a good job of getting you hooked on the game. When you are ready to kind of take the next step to owning assets, the experience there and the education that needs to happen there sort of happens outside of the game. The game itself doesn't necessarily help you with that process. And I understand that because it's hard, you know, for them to sort of explain to people step by step how to use the technology so that they can play their game. So they're sort of relying on outside forces to teach people how to jump to the next level of ownership. I kind of liken it to back in the day, like for anybody who was playing online games in like the early 2000s, like if you wanted to play Counter-Strike or some kind of other multiplayer game against your friends, you had to learn how to, you know, get a modem, you know, installed in your desktop computer. You had to learn how to like, you know, create a server, you know, how to get online, how to connect to IP addresses. Like these were all things that the games didn't do a great job of teaching you. And you instead had to rely on those friends who were already familiar with it. So we're kind of in a similar place where now people are having to learn how to use all these other technologies to play these games. And it's just going to take time and more people jumping on board to handhold the newcomers who are less familiar with it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that's actually super helpful to look back at those times and realize, you know, these things that are easy to do today weren't easy to do then. And there's this learning process to go down. I mean, what sort of talking about timelines? I mean, I know you've talked about investing in game studios and gaming right now, but like, what sort of timeline before these things are kind of mass adoption? And I understand there's a bunch of dependencies like obfuscating away the blockchain and making it more user-friendly. But what kind of back of the envelope are you looking at before, like, you know, more widespread adoption of blockchain-based games?
Yeah, I mean, the total worldwide player base of 3 billion is not something that I think blockchain games have to strive for. I think that the total addressable market for blockchain gaming probably can be in the hundreds of millions, and that's going to be completely fine in terms of having enough sort of value or money that can pay for, you know, for game development and publishers. Because the reality is the vast majority of that 3 billion that is often cited in terms of worldwide players, a lot of that are people who don't really spend any money on video games. They're just kind of downloading like free-to-play apps. And yeah, some of them are, you know, spending quite a bit of money on in-app purchases, but most aren't. The last stat I heard was that the average, you know, game player spends like $250 per year on gaming. And so because, you know, the bulk of people involved in blockchain gaming are spending considerably more per year, the size of that population can be much smaller. So mainstream for blockchain gaming is going to be different than mainstream for traditional games that require way more players to kind of, you know, make sure that 10 and 20% who's actually spending lots of money helps fuel the development of games. So very long answer to your question. I think based on what I'm seeing, based on sort of the pitch decks and what I know is in development today, I think mid to late 2023, we're going to start to see blockchain gaming player bases get into sort of the you know, 20 to 50 million mark. And then in terms of reaching 100 million, you know, that's probably going to be closer to 2024, end of that year. That probably sounds aggressive to a lot of people, but based on what I'm seeing and just kind of the rapid adoption that I've seen over the last 6 months, I think it's very doable, especially when you consider massive markets like, you know, South Korea and Europe and South America joining in on this, you know, in addition to North America. So I definitely think it's doable.
Yeah, that's an aggressive timeline, but a global permissionless world working on developing these things can move the needle quite quickly. I've heard you talked about visiting or going to GDC and talking to developers from traditional big game studios that they're super bullish on on blockchain gaming. Is this more of a tick the box, make sure that we have a blockchain Web3 strategy to make our superiors happy? Or, you know, what aspects really get them most excited kind of from the inner circle there?
Yeah, I mean, one of my sort of personal assignments for the Game Developers Conference was to talk to people who are not engrossed in the blockchain gaming space to get a pulse on, you know, how they're feeling. And so, you know, not necessarily like a total representative sample size, but I probably talked to 50 people who are, you know, who are in the traditional gaming space. And I wouldn't say they were outright bullish about blockchain gaming, but what they weren't was like, you know, vehemently against it. It was very much a combination of neutral to open and curious. And that is a very different narrative that I think is painted by traditional gamer media and other people in you know, parts of the core gamer community who make it seem like the vast majority of game developers are just openly hostile against blockchain gaming. It was pretty refreshing. And in fact, I learned that GDC originally had planned on not having any blockchain gaming related content in terms of panels, and that about 60 days before the conference began, they were getting so much interest that they ended up adding like 20 different speakers to talk about this topic because there were so many people who wanted to hear about it. And so that, I think, to me at least, showed that there is a lot of bullishness through either neutrality or curiosity from the game development community. And the bigger issue, I think, is that many of them are just a little bit hesitant to talk about it publicly because they've seen what has happened with some of the larger game studios who have, you know, hinted at looking at digital assets and NFTs and some of the really strong, like, negative reactions they've gotten. So I think people are actively building this stuff and learning about it. They're just kind of holding off on touting it until they can show that they've created something that, you know, that will be friendly to gamers and will be in their favor.
That makes sense. It sounds almost, I mean, neutral, curious, open, but it sounds a bit of a, like, gradually then suddenly it'll just take one of these bigger game studios to do it and do it well. And then it will be, you know, everybody is in. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think it's pretty much the same exact thing that happened with Fortnite, right? This idea of launching a free-to-play game and then charging money for completely aesthetic skins that, you know, don't impact the game in any way. Games were doing that to some degree before, but you never really had like a AAA game pull it off the way Fortnite did. And then once they proved that model, it became pretty common amongst the other publishers. And so I think we're still waiting for a title like that to really prove the model out for blockchain gaming. And I think that'll happen next year.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, there's these new styles of play or game mechanics that blockchain enables, and it's not just, you know, this NFT that you can move from one game to another, which probably won't happen, but, you know, still is touted by many. All right, let's transition a bit into some of your more gaming focused projects. So let's start with MetaMars and Blind Boxes, what they are, why they're important, problem they're solving. You could probably start with MetaMars.
Yeah, MetaMars has been a bit of a side project for me. I found a great, scrappy group of game developers that came together to build what I would consider like a casual or mid-core style game. And the premise is we're building what's called a no-loss arcade. So the general idea is we are asking people to deposit crypto funds into a treasury. That treasury will accumulate interest. And then that interest will be distributed back out to the best performing players of a variety of games. So for anyone who's kind of familiar with this idea of no loss lottery, that was essentially the same idea where a bunch of people pool together. That makes a really big pool of interest that is generated. And then that interest is distributed to a few lucky raffle winners. And that was kind of a fun way to like save money with a group of people. But the key to that, you know, compared to, say, a traditional lottery, is that you could always go and pull your funds out of the equation. And that's why it's called no loss. You could always walk away with the same amount of money that you put in. So that is a very much like a raffle or sort of a luck-based system. And what we wanted to do with MetaMars is create a skill-based system. And so it's the same concept, except, you know, the people who are basically top scorers on the leaderboard are the ones who are going to get the benefits of the prize pool generated by interest. And so that's kind of being built as we speak. Definitely consider it more of a side project, but it's one of, you know, a few game projects that I've been a part of. And for me, and we'll talk a little bit about this, you know, with BoardBox, but it's important for me to be able to show people, and especially game studios, that, you know, I understand how hard it is for them to do what they do. You know, without going into too much detail, like I created and published two board games. Like, I understand how difficult it is to come up with game mechanics and get your game to be visible and, you know, put all that work into sort of like the branding of your game. It's really, really tough. And so MetaMars is kind of, you know, a really important proof point for me to show that not only am I someone who's saying that I can curate, you know, the best games on the market, but also that, you know, I'm building them myself because I want to be a contributor to the ecosystem that I'm helping.
Absolutely. And like, being operator versus investor, you see how long and hard the development cycle of these things can be, and at least can empathize with the operators in which you're curating and investing in. Let's chat about board boxes, and I'll link the AMA from today's space in the show notes, because I think it was fantastic. But let's start with just the TLDR, what it is and why you get so excited about it.
Yeah. So in a nutshell, BoardBox is myself and my team curating what we believe are the best blockchain games. Anyone who's familiar with sort of the idea of a sample box like Birchbox or Loot Crate will be familiar with this idea of kind of getting a surprise box with this, you know, with samples of different things that is basically meant to introduce them to things they might not have heard of. And so we're replicating that idea in a digital format. And the concept is that we're going to be dropping board boxes that have different game items from various games. And the whole point is to help with discovery and basically save people time. So it was kind of meant to be a solution to a problem I had, which is like, I love playing video games. I don't like spending lots of time looking for the next best one or having to go into Discords and kind of do all these different actions or, you know, grind it out and do all this research about like what games I should be considering. I'd love for someone to basically just do that for me and tell me what games are awesome and what I should play. And since that didn't exist, I decided to build that company myself. And so we're going to be doing that. I'm going to be using my, you know, fairly deep experience from the video games industry to, you know, have conversations with game studios, do some vetting, and basically bring the best games, you know, to the forefront. And so the company is kind of two things. One, it's the coalition of these game items and the boxes that we'll be selling. And the second part, and the more important part that I think is more accessible to everybody, is the content that we're going to create around our drops. So every board box will be sold as a surprise. People won't know what's inside until we have basically what we're calling a reveal day. And on the reveal day, we're going to very much kind of model it after like what you would see at an E3 or a Comic-Con, where we show trailers of all the games that are inside the box and reveal it all together as a group instead of sort of an individual unboxing experience, which is what most people in the NFT space are used to. And then we'll follow that with interviews with the game developers, hearing from them, and then probably do like a really big Twitter space where we bring everybody together. And the whole thing is really going to just be game focused. It's going to be talking about game mechanics and characters and stories. And we're not going to really talk about the financials and the economics, because YouTube is full of that. You know, when you look up like information about any blockchain game, most of the content is around these games being treated as like an investment vehicle. And we're not going to focus on that. We're going to just focus on the stuff that people who love games are, you know, interested in, which is like, what is the game? Why is it cool? Tell me why the developers built it, what inspired them. And hopefully, you know, we'll fill a void in the market, which is like creating that content that everybody is looking for.
Yeah, I think curation, especially in these noisy markets in which we operate, will continue to be more and more important. So a good curator is a great product that I would think many would find a lot of value in. I sure would. So the actual box, and so my listener base typically is more investor focused, but this box that you get is filled with what? In-game skins? What are the contents of the box?
Yeah. So each box is going to have five different game items. That's the number we're going with right now. Each box will cost one ETH. So, you know, we are coming in at a premium level. Part of that is to kind of filter out the flippers, right? We want people who are really interested in owning their game assets and actually, you know, using them, playing with them. And we're working directly with the game studios to, you know, max out what those assets are. So this isn't like, you know, us arbitraging and like going and buying up a bunch of game assets and then putting them in a box. We're working very closely with each game studio that's featured in the box. And many times the items that are in the board boxes are going to be totally custom and wouldn't have existed if, you know, we hadn't done the partnership with them. In terms of the types of game assets, it's definitely going to model what people would expect to see in traditional video games. So it could be characters, skins, weapons, you know, vehicles, land. The only thing we're sort of not wanting to put in any boxes are tokens. That feels like something that is just not really a game item. That's more of like an investment vehicle. So we're not going to really touch that. But yeah, everything else is kind of on the table. And then the box itself, of course, is also an asset, which we want people to keep. So once people claim the items for their board box, it will update, the metadata will update, and essentially it'll show that it's been opened. But everyone can keep their board box that's been opened, and that will then basically convert it into more of a mint pass. And so that'll be useful for, you know, future opportunities like, you know, jumping ahead of line to buy future board boxes, getting free airdrops from our existing studio partners, events, both virtual and physical, and much, much more. So we're pretty happy about this because, you know, there are a lot of mint pass style products right now on the market where, you know, you buy something and there's kind of a promise of future assets and access and discounts and all that stuff. But the cool thing with board boxes, like, you immediately are getting stuff that you can use in games. And the goal is that we will have assets that are playable immediately. And for anything that isn't ready today, the goal is we're only including games that are, you know, basically going to launch within the next 6 months or so, or at least in 2022.
Okay, so that gets you over that timeline thing, because the number of like games that you get super excited about that are launching, you know, next month probably is significantly less than in a year when a lot more of these big game studios are coming and actually producing things that have blockchain aspects. So when curating, I mean, you're targeting gamers for discovery. Are there certain themes or niches, or like each box can kind of have a hodgepodge of different types of games that you find interesting? Like, walk me through a bit of the curation and obviously, you know, what you can disclose around these things.
Yeah. And all of the sort of mystery is really just kind of to protect the surprise, because there's a lot of value in that, in revealing kind of the, you know, the fun stuff altogether. But yeah, in terms of the box, we try to make sure that there's variety in genre of games. The reality is that not everybody, you know, likes every genre of games. So we're anticipating, you know, you get your set of five items, you might like two or three of the games that you test out. The other two, maybe are not your thing. And OpenSea is a great return policy if there are a couple items you don't like. But yeah, the idea is that we don't want to have repeat game genres in the box. So there's not going to be like four, you know, first person shooters or anything like that. So that's a part of it. We factor in time of release, of course, as mentioned before, in terms of like wanting people to be able to play sooner than later, so they're not sitting on game assets for too long. And then also chains are a consideration. So for the Genesis box, we're launching with games that are going to exist or do exist on the Ethereum network and Polygon. It's a really easy start because essentially it's the same wallet for people. It makes it really easy if you're like a MetaMask user. But ultimately, we want to be chain agnostic. So our goal is to bring people the best games, game assets, whatever chain they're on. So the plan is to expand to Solana and IMX and Avalanche as well. Those are kind of like the five big networks that we're seeing lots of games being produced on. No guarantees on the order and sort of timing of those other networks, but that's the goal. And we're going to try to keep it really easy for each box, so we don't have necessarily more than two or three different chains per box, just because we want to keep the claiming process pretty simple.
Yeah, talk about an onboarding education disaster. I mean, well, this multi-chain world that we go in, right? This will be the future, that you'll have these different assets across different ones, but it's not quite there yet. And actually, I wanted to ask, so you mentioned a lot of interest on Solana, Immutable, and Avalanche, but when talking to these big game studios about blockchain gaming, are they talking about different pros and cons of different blockchains? Are they drawn to certain blockchains more than others? I'm such an ETH bull. I'm just kind of stuck in my echo chamber of like ETH and other L1s. So, you know, asking for a friend here for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I'm also an ETH bull. I mean, I kind of feel like games on the Ethereum network are almost like games that require you to have like an overclocked like $7,000 computer. There's definitely a market for those players. But the vast majority of people want games to be running on, you know, an everyday type of laptop or on your mobile phone or on a console that's already sort of like, you know, commonly available. And so from my perspective, definitely seeing Polygon and Solana stand out because of their speed and low cost of transactions. I'm definitely also seeing, you know, again, back to Immutable and Avalanche, a lot of interest there. I think that it's a really big decision that the game publishers are making because, you know, if you think about the life cycle of game development and it taking 2-3+ years to make a game, you're kind of committing to something early. And this space changes so quickly, it can be sort of a daunting commitment to make that early, to make so early. It's almost like, you know, you have a game design idea and you have to sort of pick like what platforms you're going to build for immediately before you kind of go down the road of like building the overall infrastructure of the game. So it's like saying, okay, we're going to build for PlayStation and Nintendo Switch, but we haven't really even started coding yet. And so you have to kind of commit to that for the next 3 years. So it's a little bit of a tough issue, but you know, back to your original question, I think that, yeah, these like L2 solutions that are fast and cheap are working quite well. And many people argue they're less secure, but I think that's okay because game assets typically are not as high value as other digital assets where like security is as important. And so people are willing to kind of give up a little bit of security to get that speed.
Yeah, that makes sense. So, I mean, do you see board boxes as a way to get more gamers into blockchain or more NFT nerds into gaming? Or kind of how do you see that as in terms of onboarding?
Yeah, I think that at least for now, our hypothesis is the perfect candidate for our product is somebody who is fairly knowledgeable about crypto, you know, has like a web wallet or a Coinbase account, maybe does a little bit of DeFi, and then also really likes traditional video games. We're not necessarily going after people who are playing the current roster of blockchain games. We think that's a different person. And I think our premium pricing probably, you know, cements that hypothesis. But yeah, it's somebody who, you know, is comfortable spending thousands of dollars per year on gaming. I'm one of those people. And that's why we're starting small, right? With a thousand boxes per drop. I kind of like have joked about this model we're taking being very similar to Tesla. Like when Tesla came out, they started at the top end with luxury, right? Selling $100,000 plus cars to a few people. And then as they got bigger and as the market became more accepting of electric vehicles, they were able to increase the volume and lower the price. And I think we'll be able to do the exact same thing. It's just that the market right now won't support that. And so, yeah, that's, you know, we're keeping that in mind in terms of who we go for. But again, like we don't necessarily want people to feel excluded or priced out. So even if, you know, the price of the Genesis board boxes are not necessarily accessible to everyone, we want the content and the events to be, you know, free for everybody and accessible because we want to just, you know, use that for education and entertainment, regardless of, you know, whether you own a board box or not.
Super awesome. Where can listeners find out a little bit more about board boxes? Then I have a few more questions than the audience in this Twitter spaces. Raise your hand and I'll start bringing you up in the next 5-10 minutes or so. But where can listeners find out more about board boxes and get involved?
Yeah, we just updated boardbox.io, which is our website. We'll continue to provide updates there, but there's an FAQ and more information. My big recommendation is for people to follow the Telegram link. If you're a Telegram user, that's going to basically serve as our source of truth and where we'll be sharing news first. We're not planning on using a Discord anytime soon because we feel like our mission is to save people time and give them more time to play. And Telegram is a very, you know, easy and clean way to kind of just get updates and then go about your business. So those are kind of the two areas. And of course, Boardbox on Twitter, it's Boardbox_ some individual owns Boardbox and won't give it up, but Boardbox_ on Twitter is our handle. And then, yeah, and honestly, just tweet at me and send questions, criticize, whatever. I'm pretty approachable and spend a lot of time responding to people. So always happy to have those chats live.
I can't imagine your DMs. That's a disaster. But I will say that the graphic looks absolutely amazing. So whoever designed that on the new website launch, it looks really, really good. So super excited. Thank you. Yeah, can't wait. Okay, a few questions, then we'll open up to the audience. But, you know, the Web3 crypto space is huge. Obviously, you're very involved and interested in blockchain gaming. If you weren't so focused on blockchain gaming, what's the second most interesting area in Web3 right now to you, and why? More from like an investment perspective, risk return potential for the investors and the audience.
Okay, got it. I feel like the answer I'm going to give you is very boring, but it's basically DeFi and banking. I think that people have just had it with traditional banking, the overdraft fees, the transaction fees, the lack of interest, the difficulty in lending. We are not able to use our money the way we want to. The fact that banks are closed at certain times, you cannot go and withdraw your own money, is insane to me, you know, in 2022. And so I think that just, you know, decentralized finance is presenting itself as the future of banking and the future of, you know, all things that banks essentially do. And yes, it has lots of risk and oversight needs and, you know, onboarding issues. But fundamentally, the good actors in the space are really trying to solve for the enormous levels of consumer unfriendliness that exists in the banking industry. So as an investor, I think as an overall genre, I think that's a huge area of investment. The challenge is that it's also pretty easy to spin up banking solutions in DeFi. So there's a lot of risk and you don't necessarily know, you know, which projects are going to exist a year from now and which ones are going to collapse. So yeah, it's a highly volatile space. I offer no specific investment advice to anyone other than DeFi is an interesting space that you should learn about. Whereas in terms of where you should put your money, I'll leave that to Ben and people who are smarter than me.
Well, and I'll preface that with nothing in this podcast is financial advice, you know, all the disclaimers that are supposed to be said. But I do know that there are quite a few alternative investors that listen to this. What else in the space gets you, like, I mean, talking to some of these guys that are kind of novices to Web3, I'm a bit of a crypto permeable, as are so some of my friends. What kind of outliers or things that could like sink this ship that we're, you know, not really thinking about?
I mean, the other area of interest, and it's a different kind of an investment, I guess you could say an alternative investment, is identity. So there's of course, you know, monetary investments, but your identity is also an asset, right? Like my pseudonym of Bored Elon Musk is a valuable asset. Like if I wanted to sell it, I suppose I could. I wouldn't want to. But the problem or the challenge that the people are trying to solve for is that the identity is hard to, you know, sort of actually have like true ownership of. And it's also hard to like fork it or transfer it. So I'll kind of elaborate on what I'm saying. Like my identity primarily right now exists on Twitter. Twitter is a privately held company now that is, you know, soon to be owned by a friend. And, you know, ultimately, if for whatever reason I am no longer deemed an appropriate user of that service, I could lose my account. I think that's highly unlikely. I'm a pretty good actor, you know, not violating any policies. So I'm not super worried about it. But the fact remains is that I am renting my identity. The primary source of distribution that I have and the reach that I have is being rented from Twitter. And so I would like to see, you know, the crypto space kind of solve for that and for me to be able to own that identity the same way I might be able to own a game asset or a token or any other sort of digital item. And then two is like the transferability. If people opt into following me or being part of, you know, my community, and then I want to sort of fork that or shift it to another platform, I don't necessarily want to have to restart from scratch, from zero, to have to do that. It would be great to bring people with me. The closest sort of, you know, version of this is like email. If you have an email list, you can take all those addresses and move it over to a new distribution place and, you know, start a new newsletter and bring everybody with you. That doesn't really work in pretty much every other context in terms of like social media. So I would also like to see that evolve. So as an investment, again, it's not a monetary investment, but I think that you should, or people should, treat their online presence as an asset that needs to be protected and that should be, you know, looked at as something that needs to kind of continue to evolve and be nourished. And you should be able to add features to it that maybe we don't have today.
Very good points. I mean, me personally, I'm super bullish on Web3 or decentralized identity. I know it's very early stages for this, but it will be solved eventually, and it will be solved well in an eloquent manner. But yeah, definitely early stages. So great advice there. Board, this has been fantastic. Where can my listeners, when this is produced as a podcast, find out more about you, or where would you like to send them?
Yeah, good old @BoardElonMusk on Twitter is the place to go. I've secretly been trying to acquire the @Board handle on Twitter, just @Board. It is currently a dormant or suspended account, and I'm hoping that maybe some friends at Twitter can help me with that. But for now, @BoardElonMusk is the handle, and by all means, again, encourage people to reach out with questions, and always good for a spirited debate on Twitter.
Awesome. And I'll link that. I'll link the AMA, I'll link Board Boxes, all the good goodies in the show notes when this goes live. Board, really appreciate you coming on today. It's been awesome. Lots of good alpha dropped here, and really excited to see all that you're doing in the space.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Thanks for the great questions and conversation.
There you have it. Thank you for listening. Really appreciate your support. Show notes, transcript, links, and more can be found on our website at altassetallocation.com. If you'd be so kind, please share this with anyone you think might be interested or get some value from this conversation. If you have any questions or comments, please reach out. I'm always happy to hear them. Lastly, if you're on YouTube, please like the video or subscribe to the channel. If you're listening to the audio version of this, please subscribe to the podcast and or leave a review. This really helps more people find the podcast, and I really appreciate it. Thanks again, and hope you have a fantastic day. Happy investing.